Welcome to the DTB podcast for May 2024, volume 62, number 5. My name is David Fazakerly and I'm DTB's deputy editor.
Hello, I'm James Cave, editor-in-chief.
Thank you for joining us for this podcast, which we are recording in the second week of April. I want to start by picking up something from last month's podcast, during which we talked about various aspects of drug safety. The editorial discussed limited effect that some safety alerts have had, and that implementing them successfully requires providing people with more than just facts, but with evidence, clinical advice, training, tools, as well as practical support. And we also highlighted the MHRA's latest drug safety update on valproate, which included details of education materials and some of the safety measures that have been introduced. Now, a listener kindly pointed out that we didn't make any reference to some of the practical tools and resources that are available on NHS England's website, including a useful patient decision aid, which in some ways neatly illustrates the point of the editorial that implementing drug safety notices needs a joined-up approach and easy access to resources. So thank you for pointing out our omission. I've been back and had a quick look, and there is a link to the clinical resources on the MHRA's guidance page on valproate use by women and girls, but the link isn't on the MHRA's valproate page on safety measures. So it's a little confusing and maybe easy to miss. James, what do you think?
Yeah, and the NHS England website is actually really useful, and there is actually a patient safety section, and it's not just covering sodium valproate. There are a number of other safety issues discussed on it, which are really useful. And I think the problem we've got is there are so many elements to the complex pathways involved in healthcare that I think it's sometimes very difficult for everyone to remain joined up. And it may well be that ICBs will improve this, perhaps, the concept that there'll be fewer organisations that are covering a bigger area. So one perhaps can hope that things will improve. But yes, well pointed out. And it is a website, just NHS. Well, it's just england.nhs.uk/patient safety. And you'll find a lot of really useful information there.
I mean, I'll add the links to both the patient safety page and the sodium valproate page on the notes that accompany this podcast, so people can find them easily. So thank you to the GP who pointed out our omission. And yes, keep telling us if we don't do things or don't say things that you think we should. Okay, so let's move on to the editorial this month, which is one you wrote, James. Medicines and global warming, a complex problem. Do you want to say a bit about it?
Yes, I just thought it was time that we looked at this at DTB. The healthcare sector is responsible for a significant proportion of global greenhouse emissions, probably about almost 5%. And of that, the footprint of the biotech and pharmaceutical industries is big. I mean, there are some concerns about how you do measure the emissions of various industries. But in 2021, it was estimated that the global emissions from biotech and pharmaceutical industries was 260 million tons of carbon dioxide, which was actually bigger than the emissions from the forestry and paper industry. So it's a big element that is obviously challenging our ability to tackle global warming. And I just thought it was quite interesting to look at that, look at what's going on within industry and also within the NHS at trying to reduce emissions across the board.
And there have been some NHS initiatives, haven't there, to tackle drugs in particular. I think you point out a couple of those in editorial.
Yeah, that's right. So obviously the one we perhaps all talked about in primary care is the shift to dry powder inhaler devices for respiratory illnesses. Interesting enough, I was talking to someone who was involved in the move towards CFC-free gas MDIs back in whenever long ago it was, and he pointed out that actually the old propellants were less global warming than the CFC-free ones. But so it's interesting how, be careful what you wish for. But the other interesting thing is, yes, the anaesthetic gas there's fluorine is also being phased out because, of course, these anesthetic gases are just vented to the atmosphere from operating theatres, and they're being phased out. So, yeah, so there's, the NHS has got plans to be what are called Scope 1 emissions, which are the direct running, if you like, of the system. Scope 1 emissions, they're looking to reduce those to net zero by 2040. And the other emissions that come around, both your supply chain and what you do to people, if you like, or the sort of secondary effects of your industry. So, for example, people driving to and from outpatients will be a Scope 3 emission, if you like, and they're looking to get those down to net zero by 2045, and, you know, really very ambitious targets. And I think one of the things that's very interesting about the medicines element of this is actually it's very complex to decarbonize the pharmaceutical industry. First of all, a lot of the manufacturing base is in the Asia Pacific region, and actually a lot of the energy supplies there are still fossil fuel based. Also, you know, it's very complex, the raw materials that are used in medicines, and it's a very highly regulated system. So you can't just say, well, let's just switch one of the incipients of this drug to another so that we can reduce our CO2 emissions, because that may require national regulatory approval. So there's lots of difficulties there, but in an analysis of the 20 largest pharmaceutical companies, actually 19 have committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and 10 have actually committed to sort of carbon neutrality between 2025 and 2050. So the industry is working at it, and if you like, the organisation, the NHS, is looking at it. But the last element that I thought was missing in all this is, I think actually what is required to get medication and therapeutics and medicine to be carbon neutral is also an element of us really looking at what we're doing and asking ourselves, does what I'm doing make sense in an environment where we're trying to reduce carbon dioxide emissions? And I suppose what I'm talking about here is this concept of joining everything up. You see someone who's overweight, do I give them drugs which are going to have a carbon cost, if you like? Or if we can get people doing lifestyle changes, cycling more, you know, all those elements, then actually we can make people healthier and reduce carbon emissions. So something about not only looking at the drugs themselves and how carbon neutral they are, but how carbon neutral are you as a prescriber? How good are you at looking at not over-diagnosing, not over-investigating, and not over-treating? And I think those elements have not even been discussed yet. And yet I think they form a really important part of the whole approach to a carbon neutral health system.
You know, because I suppose it's very easy to just request another blood test when you're not quite sure. But do we know what the carbon impact is of every blood test we order? So yes, the whole point of thinking about, are we over-investigating, mm-hmm. and as you say, over-treating and then over-diagnosing is, I haven't heard that really mentioned in the context of environmental issues.
No, I don't think it has been, has it? And I think, you know, organising an outpatient appointment, well, does that patient really need to get in a car and drive to the hospital? Can we use technology to actually do a virtual appointment? You know, when is it important that we see someone? It's fascinating, just, you know, and as I say, around the lifestyle versus medication approach, I think that would be very interesting to see how different drugs differ in their carbon footprint and whether that has an impact. You know, as you say, we've already looked at dry powder inhalers. You know, they're responsible, well, not they, but the MDIs that we're replacing, they're responsible for 7% of the NHS's carbon footprint. So it's an important element, but actually not using inhalers unnecessarily is also a really important element to this.
And then the other aspect, which we've always been looking at, always been trying to solve but never have, which is that of wasted medicines. And, you know, think of all the effort that goes into producing, manufacturing, dispensing, giving them to patients, and then the bucket loads that come back that are just not used, and then you're paying for those to be destroyed at a carbon cost in the destruction process. And again, it seems to be another area that we've never quite solved in reducing waste.
It is, and as you say, and it's so often the inhalers, isn't it? I remember someone bringing back something like 100 Seretide inhalers, and they were costing about £50 a piece at the time. And that's just the financial cost. But as you say, now we've got the carbon cost as well. So, yeah, it's a really important area. And so I thought it made sense to have an editorial and just open up that for discussion.
And just a quick question to finish with. Has your, from what you've seen from your clinical practice, has there been much engagement with addressing environmental issues beyond the kind of the inhaler? Is it kind of local leadership that's driving this, or is it really just down to individual practices to sort themselves out?
Do you know, that's really interesting. There is an NHS initiative to try and get practices to look at their carbon footprint, but the finances being what they are, certainly locally, I'm not aware of any practice that's even thinking about that at the moment. You know, they're just trying to get the nurse in on the Monday, or, you know, it's just firefighting at the moment. But you're right. I mean, in a lot of general practice buildings, you know, you're either working out of old stock or you're working out of buildings that were built in the 1990s and 1980s. And they're not renowned for their efficiency when it comes to their carbon footprint. So, yes, there's a lot of work to be done in the management of carbon dioxide emissions from healthcare, for sure.
Okay, well, I'm sure we're going to come back to this several times. But anyway, thank you for that. Let's move on to the DTB Select item this month, which looks at a trial for a new drug for Alzheimer's disease. We've obviously had a few in the offing recently. Do you want to talk a bit about this one?
Yeah, so this is donanemab, which is an Eli Lilly drug that's not yet been licensed, I think, anywhere in the world yet. I don't think it has yet. But it's one of these drugs. It's a monoclonal antibody. It's this one that's, well, there are about three others. And these are the drugs that have been demonstrated to actually achieve this reduction in the amyloid plaques, which is felt to be one of the significant pathologies that causes Alzheimer's disease. And this is what we're looking at is Trailblazer ALZ2, which was a phase 3 trial for patients with early Alzheimer's disease, 76 weeks, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. So they were comparing donanemab against placebo in patients between the ages of 60 and 85 with early symptomatic Alzheimer's. And because this drug seems to be aiming it at amyloid and tau pathology, these patients all had had PET scans to confirm they had this pathology in place. Eli Lilly have sort of talked about these drugs being very effective and reducing the deterioration in sort of cognitive function by 20%. They've used the relative risk reduction. And in our Select article, we go through what that actually means. Because although that sounds quite good, when you look at the primary outcome, which was a change in a scoring system called the IADRS, which was actually designed by Lilly to enable them to demonstrate effectiveness. What it shows is you get a difference of 3 points between the donanemab group and the placebo group after 76 weeks. And that was where they talked about the 20% improvement. But the feeling is that you need about a 5-point change for there to be a clinically meaningful change. So this is a drug that really is demonstrating that it can actually affect and remove amyloid plaques. So remarkably, 34% of the group who had intermediate amyloid plaques had achieved clearance at 6 months, and 71% had achieved clearance of these amyloid plaques by the 12 months. But actually the improvement, or the lack of decline, because no one improved, these people didn't improve in their cognitive function. It just didn't decline as much as it did in the placebo group. So it's it feels a bit to me like we're at the same stage as we were with some other illnesses like diabetes in the past. This is an interesting drug, but is it going to actually demonstrate real clinical effectiveness? Is yet to be proved.
And they are, and I think they all are, this in this sort of group, associated with some quite nasty adverse effects.
Absolutely. So there's this concern that you get edema, effusions, microhemorrhages, and hemosiderin deposits on the brain as a result of that. I think the incidence of severe amyloid-related abnormalities was about 2%. And about 17% of the donanemab group versus about 16% in the placebo group had these serious adverse events. So it is a drug with a bit of a sting in the tail. And as yet, as I say, I'm not aware that it's been licensed anywhere. But there was a lot of sort of positive media spin on this drug when the study came out. I think it was in summer 23. But at the moment, it's just another one of these drugs which is yet to demonstrate true benefit.
And I think people have, as you describe the outcomes, people have tried to put some numbers to it, don't they? And they talk about a 4-month slowing down of disease progression, which may well be beneficial. But what strikes me with all these drugs is the infrastructure you have to have in place to make them work. So you've got to be able to diagnose early. You've got to be able to scan people. You've got to be able to administer, because these are given intravenously. And you've got to be able to monitor people. So there is a lot involved in infrastructure, setup, and ongoing maintenance that these drugs will need before you can even use them. And I just wonder, how far off is the NHS, even if they do get licensed, how far off is the NHS in actually being able to manage their introduction?
Totally. And the other thing is that, you know, take that cost. How much is a PET scan now? Take all those costs, and if you were to provide care to those families and to those people at a higher quality level because of that ability to pay them that money, would that give you a better quality of life than simply sending you down to outpatients to have your injection once a month? And that's, no one's doing that. No one's doing a trial of let's spend that money in a different way to actually support people with Alzheimer's and give them the sorts of support that keeps them confident and happy in their homes. So it's a really difficult one, this. And I think, this, the jury is definitely out. We'll see where this goes. But I think there's a long way before we know, or we've got, my own personal feeling is, I think that given that they removed all the plaques in 71% of people by 12 months, and yet there was so little difference in outcome from the cognitive situation, I just wonder, are we looking at an association rather than a causation here? And are we missing the golden bullet at the moment?
Well, let's wait and see if you're proved right. But I think, yes, it'd be interesting, how these drugs, will they be approved, but then also what happens to them in clinical practice? So watch this space, and we'll see what happens next with them. I'm sure there'll be more news before too long. So let's move on to our main article this month, which is an overview of a interestingly new old drug, or old new drug, for smoking cessation. Again, do you want to talk us through what it is, where it's come from, and what it does?
This is an old drug. This is cytisine, which is a drug that's been around for about 50 years and has been used quite widely in Eastern Europe, Russia in particular. And this is a plant alkaloid that is very similar to nicotine, and it's used and has been used as a way of helping people stop smoking cessation aid. And basically, cytisine, is very similar to nicotine. It binds to the same receptors. It's got a weaker action than nicotine, so you don't get the dopamine hit that you get when nicotine binds. It also binds harder, so the idea is it knocks nicotine off the receptors, so it basically blocks the action of nicotine. It's a tablet, It's 1.5 milligrams. You start taking it every 2 hours. That's 6 tablets a day on the first day. And over 25 days, you reduce the amount of tablets you take. Over that time, you're advised to stop smoking within the first 5 days. And that's how it works. The idea is that by the end of the 25 days, you've stopped the tablets, you've stopped smoking. And it costs about £115 for a course. Lots of evidence surrounds it. That's the good news. It's been around for so long that we've got multiple systematic reviews. We've got 2 Cochrane systematic reviews, as well as a more recent one in 2023. So we've looked at those in this article, and it's a very useful comparative table comparing quit rates between nicotine replacement therapy, nortriptyline, bupropion, which was Zyban, and varenicline or Champix. So you've got all the different options that have been available both now and in the past, and compared them with cytosine. Bottom line is it's more effective than placebo. It's more effective than nicotine replacement therapy. And it seems to be more effective than Zyban. It seems to be similarly effective to Champix and nicotine-containing e-cigarettes. So it is an interesting option to have. Is it cost-effective? It's difficult to say. Obviously, the other options are quite a bit cheaper, apart from nicotine replacement therapy, which, depending on what people choose and how long they take it for, can cost up to £200 per person. I was looking at the table comparing the quit rates between the various options, and it looked like it costs about £1,400 for every additional quitter, if you like, using cytosine. If you look at how many more people will quit with that compared to placebo, but it does seem to be effective, and has been licensed, I think, since August 2023.
And as you say, it's been around in some form in some countries for a long time. So I guess it's kind of safety profile is probably better known than we would have for other new drugs. And given, you know, the problems with the varenicline at the moment, and it's just not been available, it does give people the option of something else to try, doesn't it?
It does, and I think there are some people who prefer a tablet treatment. I know that sounds odd, but I think some people find the other sorts of options not up their street. It's odd. It's not licensed in people over the age of 65, which surprised me. I couldn't quite work out why that might be. And it's not licensed for anyone under 18. And obviously there's concerns around using it in pregnancy and all those usual caveats. And its side effects seem to be similar to that of nicotine, things like appetite changes, dizziness, anxiety, sleep disorders, nausea, heartburn. But as you say, I think we can be as confident as we ever are, given the amount it's been used, that doesn't seem to be any significant nasty adverse effects that we're unaware of. And it is an option that is available for that sort of hardcore of smokers who are continuing to smoke even now.
I mean, NICE are going to look at, or they're going to update their tobacco control sort of guidance to include reference to it. I don't know whether it'll be just this is another option you may wish to consider, or whether they'll actually give it a full-blown appraisal, but they are looking at it, so wait and see what they say. Is it something, how many smokers do you see, or do they all go to local services when you need to advise people on smoking cessation?
Yeah, the local smoking cessation sort of organisation seems to have quietly faded away. I know when I was involved in NHS leadership that it was costing our local area about £400,000 a year. And I think that's been heavily cut back now. I mean, I cover quite an affluent patch, and it's actually quite rare now to see a smoker. You probably only see one or two not even a day. It is unusual now in my patch, but I But as I say, for people who have tried everything else, this might, well, they always say, don't they, the more you try to quit smoking, the more successful you'll be at quitting smoking. So at the end of the day, if there's something else someone can try, there's a lot more chance they're going to quit than if they've given up.
Okay, thank you very much for that. You can find these and all our articles on our website at dtb.bmj.com. All our podcasts are also there. There's a podcast button at the top of the webpage. As ever, if you want to get involved with DTB, let us know. Feedback on our podcast, feedback on our articles. Always happy to have comments. Our email address is dtb@bmj.com. So just remains me to say thank you for listening, and I hope you'll be able to join us in a month's time for our June 2024 podcast.